going. Yeah, I wish I knew sign language. Daniel. Wow. Yeah, I'll just type it out up here. I can probably type faster than I can talk anyway, which is saying a lot. No. You know, back in the days of the old Apple IIe computers, you guys remember those green screens? And they were not fast machines by any stretch. And we had a teacher at the school I went to that could out-type them, the computer. She could type in the computer faster than it could register her keystrokes. If you want to confuse a computer, it's a good way to do it. Okay. So we're in 2 Kings chapter 18, and I think we need to play catch up a little bit because it's been several weeks since we've gone over these things. And I know how easy it is to remember all the names of these kings, like like Joash and Amaziah and Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah and Zechariah and all those fellas, and Pekah. Yeah, most of them end in Iah, so. That's like, what's that? 2 Kings 18. Kathy, you didn't name all your kids with the same starting letter, did you? No? Okay. Yeah, you do. Yeah, that's where you all, yeah. I can't tell you apart anymore. That's right. So we're covering this period of history. We are, we're probably 250 years into the divided kingdom. So Rehoboam splits the kingdom in 975 BC, and we've been discussing events that are going on. Hezekiah takes the throne in 726, so that's just about 250 years. And we've mostly been talking about these first 2 years of Hezekiah's reign. He takes over the throne from his father Ahaz, and Ahaz was a faithful guy or an unfaithful guy? Pete, put those away, not right now. I'm sorry, say that again? He was an unfaithful guy, very, very unfaithful. What kinds of things did he do that displayed his unfaithfulness? Sacrificed his children to the gods in the fire, yep. He didn't destroy the temple, but he closed it down, shut it down. What else? Yeah, he put idols in the temple, and then he filled Jerusalem with idols, so this was a fun guy to be around. That's religiously speaking, he destroyed the city of Jerusalem and Judea as far as their obedience to the law goes. Politically speaking, he made Israel a vassal state to what major nation? Assyria, right. So if we scroll up here, we can see Tiglath-Pileser was the king in Assyria, while Ahaz was king. Here, when Hezekiah takes the throne, it's right about the same time another guy named Shalmaneser takes the throne of Assyria. Shalmaneser begins what major event in the northern kingdom? Right, he begins the siege of Jerusalem. And historically, we know that Shalmaneser couldn't finish the siege of Jerusalem. He died, and so his general, who then became king, is Sargon III. So Sargon actually finished the destruction of Samaria in the northern kingdom, and that would be right around Hezekiah's fifth year when Samaria was destroyed. But since Hezekiah took over a very broken and battered kingdom from his father Ahaz, he spent the first year of his reign reestablishing the worship of Jehovah in the southern kingdom. He cleanses the temple, opens the doors. The priests have to spend 16 days cleansing the temple premises and reestablishing the patterns of worship in the temple. And since he took the beginning of his year would start in the first month of the year, and it took them 15 days or 16 days, they missed the date for the Passover, which would have been the 14th day of the first month. So he finds provision in the law of Moses that if a person is unclean and unable to keep the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, God says you can keep the Passover on the 14th day of the second month. And so he calls the entire nation to celebrate Passover on the 14th day of the second month of his first year. And the whole nation does. And he even invites the northern kingdom down. So if that's this year, Hosea is still sitting on the throne in the northern kingdom. Hezekiah sends envoys all throughout the northern kingdom. And what was the response of the northern kingdom? Yeah, they didn't respond very well, did they? Most of the cities rejected the invitation. Some of them laughed the envoys out of town. But there were a few people that decided to travel to Jerusalem for that Passover. And so Hezekiah is able to celebrate the largest Passover since the days of Solomon. We're talking 300 years or 250 plus years it's been going. It hasn't been this kind of a Passover in Israel for 250 plus years. Imagine trying to reinstate a tradition that's been dead for 250 years. I mean, we're America. We're not even 250 years old. We don't even have any traditions that go back that far. Start thinking about ourselves as a pretty young country in the history of the world when we realize there are there are buildings over in Europe and in other places in the world that are older than people even knew this country existed. Yeah, we're pretty young in the scheme of things. Well, Hezekiah, that's what he spends his first year doing. So after that Passover, the people go throughout Jerusalem and Judea, and they take down all the idols that Ahaz had set up, and they purify the entire country. And we get this in verse 5 of chapter 18, 2 Kings 18, we get this summary of Hezekiah. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. He held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him. Wherever he went out, he prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. So this is the initial part of Hezekiah's reign. After the reforms of his first year, he undertakes some military campaigns in the following couple of years, probably years 2 and 3. Who does he conquer? Not the Assyrians. Who does he conquer there? The Philistines, right. Israel's longtime enemy. These people have been living down there on the coastal regions of the Mediterranean Sea for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they've been a constant source of trouble, all the way going back to the time of Samuel when the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. And even before that, the Philistines were a problem. So here they are 400 years later, and they're still being a problem. But Hezekiah is able to subdue them quite a bit. Now, that's in the first few years of his reign, but then what happens in the northern kingdom? At the end of Hosea's reign, Samaria is destroyed. The capital city is laid to ruin. The people are deported out of the northern kingdom and scattered across the Assyrian Empire, and the Assyrians bring in other people to inhabit Samaria. We talked about the effect that that has in the creation of the Samaritans. A whole different group of people. But verses 9 and following tell us, again, the fall of the northern kingdom. So this is the second recounting of the fall of Samaria. Because it was such a major event, the historian recounts it for us 2 times. I guess he doesn't recount it 2 times. He counts it twice. So 1 count and 1 recount. And a further would be a re-recount. And so on and so forth, right? And so he summarizes again the fall of Samaria in the northern kingdom. And that's Hezekiah's fourth year. The fourth year is when the siege started. The seventh year would be when it was completed and fell. So then we get to verse 13, and where does the historian pick up? What year? The 14th year of Hezekiah. So you say, wow, what happened to those intervening 7 years? Wouldn't you like to know? Well, things just must have been going along pretty smoothly. But if we're going to pick up in year 14, there was a major event that happened back in verse 7. The end of verse 7, what does it say that Hezekiah did? He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. How do you think the king of Assyria is going to take that? What did the king of Assyria just do to Samaria for rebelling? Leveled the city, right? What kind of courage does it take for Hezekiah to say, yeah, we're not going to serve Assyria either? That takes a lot of courage, doesn't it? Where did that courage come from? Came from God, right? What's the statement that it says right before he rebelled? The Lord was with him. Whenever he went out, he prospered. Back in verse 6, he held fast to the Lord. So here's part of the evidence of Hezekiah's holding fast to the Lord. He's willing to take these huge steps of faith. Assyria is the biggest country in the world at this point. They have the strongest military. They are conquering everybody they encounter. And it's not just faraway stuff. It's right next door. The northern kingdom has fallen and been destroyed because of Assyria. And yet Hezekiah is willing to take that step and say, no, we're not going to serve the Assyrians anymore. So that's where we pick up in verse 13. Israel has been prospering under Hezekiah. But now, verse 13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. So how's this rebellion going for Hezekiah? If the king of Assyria is able to capture all the fortified cities of Judah, how's the rebellion going for Hezekiah? Slow. That's the eternal optimist right there. It's a slow start, but we're gaining momentum. Yeah, they're hanging in there. Yeah, it's bad for the unfortified cities, right. So, yeah, why does it only mention the fortified cities, Daniel? Right. Fortified cities are where all the storehouses of weapons would be, the food, and all the soldiers. So you don't worry too much about the unfortified cities. Studying World War II history, it always amazed me that the plan of action was generally, if your lines are here, was to shoot out and surround the enemy. And you didn't worry about defeating the enemy. You just cut off their supply line, and then they would surrender. That was the idea. That way you don't have to do much fighting and killing. I mean, you had to fight and kill, but the idea was to surround as many troops as possible and hold them in that small area until they run out of bullets and food and water, and then they have to surrender. And that's kind of the idea behind the siege. Kathy?
Did you ever see that documentary? I can't remember what they called it, but they actually went and they were made up of all kinds of men, actors, all kinds of people. They actually made inflatables that looked real life from the air to fool the enemy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we had lots of fun ruses like that. That happened at one major battle in the Civil War, too. I think, was it McClellan, the general, the initial general in the Civil War for the Union side? And he was a real slow, methodical mover. Drove Abraham Lincoln nuts. Because he would just move the army by slow, incremental steps. And he was surrounding this southern city. And it took him forever to get there and move his cannons into place where he could start bombarding the city. Well, while he was doing that, the southern people retreated. And they left like a skeleton crew in the city, and they painted logs and put them in the cannon spots so they look like cannons. And so McKellen got, I think it was McKellen, I might be wrong on this, but McKellen got there and started pummeling the city. And then they go in to take it and find out there's nobody there. It's all logs and guys with black sticks. They don't even have any weapons. They all retreated. So I think that might have been the last battle McKellen fought before they promoted Grant. I'm a little off. I think I'm a little off on that. But yeah. Would you feel? Sometimes you earn a promotion, and sometimes the guy above you unearns his, right? So that's just the way it goes. But yeah, we had lots of fun ruses like that in those wars. I'm trying to bring up here for you the map so we can see a little bit of what's going on here. So here's the area we're talking about. Hezekiah initially went down here and conquered the Philistines area, all the way down to Gaza, which is this city way down here in the south. So everything north of this line has been captured by the Assyrians and has been taken over. And so Hezekiah is ruling here from Jerusalem, and he's now in control of this area. But when the Assyrians get word that Hezekiah has stopped paying his tribute money, they send in the army, and they begin systematically taking over all of the fortified cities. So they may have come down and captured some of these Philistine cities. Ekron, Gath, Gaza, Lachish, those were huge cities, very, very important. And they may have moved their way in from that area up toward Jerusalem. But the point is, he's captured all the fortified cities and took them. Verse 14, Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. So yes, he actually has taken this city of Lachish down here. And what does he tell the king of Assyria? I did wrong. Yep. I have done wrong. Withdraw from me, and whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So this is the royal apology. Okay, you've smashed my country to smithereens. I've got nothing left to stand against you, so my only hope is to capitulate, surrender, and hope that you don't lay on me such a huge burden that I cannot bear up under it. Or, in Hezekiah's place, hope that you don't remove me from the throne through execution for my rebellion and put somebody else on the throne. So I will bear whatever you bring. And the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. We've done a little bit of this math before. Tim, do you have a calculator back there? Gary, you've got... No, you just have your phone there. You got a calculator? Okay, so we're going to do a little bit of quick calculation. 300 talents of silver. So a talent is about 75 pounds, so multiply 300 by 75. 22,500 pounds of silver he wants, okay? Now, in order to get a price for that, let's multiply it by the number of ounces in a pound, which is 16. So 22,500 times 16 equals 360,000 ounces. I checked. You know what the going rate for silver is today? $15. So let's multiply that by $15. $5,400,000. Okay. I mean, how many of us could come up with $5,400,000? It'd be a stretch. Maybe if I sell off my baseball card collection and... No. I don't collect baseball cards. But that's not a crazy amount of money, especially when you're talking about nations. I mean, what's our state in debt? Something like $200 billion. It's a lot of money. But okay, that's just the silver. $5.5 million in silver. Now let's do gold. So how many talents of gold does he want? 30. He wants 30 talents of gold. So let's do the same math. 30 times 75 times 16. That'll give us the ounces of gold. 306,000 ounces. Okay, that sounds better. 36,000 ounces of gold. Now, do you know what the going price for gold is today? I checked. What's that, Gary? It's $1,354 an ounce today. Yeah, it's going down quite a bit. So multiply that number, 36,000, by 1,354. Nope, $1,354 for an ounce of gold. Yeah. Nope, I think you missed something there. 36,000 times 1,354. Yep. Only 4 million? I think you're doing your math wrong. I'm going to bring up my own calculator, not because I don't trust you, but because I think you're wrong. All right. So 30 talents of silver or of gold times 75 pounds equals 2250 times 16. That's 36,000 ounces times 1,354. Close enough. 48 million. What were you saying, Tim? Oh, okay. We might have missed a number in there somewhere. So right around, we're talking about $53 to $54 million this guy wants, and that's just the apology money. That's not what's going to come every year after that. Okay, this is just to get you back in the good graces of the king of Assyria. Over $50 million in gold and silver. Now, we're talking about, too, a nation that's not even as big as Illinois. We're about 120 miles tall, about 40 miles across. Not even that big at that time. So we're talking about a little tiny nation here. That's a huge, huge amount of money. So where's Hezekiah going to get this money? Verse 15, Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. And at that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts that Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. So all of the reforms and the beautifying of the temple that Hezekiah had to do in the beginning of his reign, he now has to undo in order to keep the king of Assyria out of Judah. Does it work? Does that save Judah from the king of Assyria? So, Hezekiah in the beginning of his reign, it says he clung to the Lord. Was he trusting the Lord in this decision? That's a tough call, isn't it? What would you do? Your nation's surrounded by a huge army, the largest in the world, the most powerful army in the world. And you think, well, I could save my last city by paying this ransom. Abby? Beg for mercy. Well, that's pretty much what he did. He handed the city to them and begged for mercy, didn't he? Tough call. I don't know what I would do in that situation. But it doesn't work. Because look at what happens after this. The king of Assyria, verse 17. The king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshaka with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they arrived, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway to the washer's field. And when they called for their king, they came out to them Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. So the king of Assyria sends this envoy, these three military commanders, and a massive army. They come and they camp out. They camp out in right next to Jerusalem, just outside the walls. And they call out to the walls. They want to talk to Hezekiah. Here's what they're going to say in verse 19. The Rabshakeh said to them, "Say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you are trusting now in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff, which will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. So the Rabshakeh says to Hezekiah, you shouldn't trust who? Don't trust Egypt. Now, why do you think the king of Assyria is maybe camped right here in Lachish? Yeah, keep Hezekiah from going to Egypt. Keep Egypt from coming up. And guess where he's heading? Every major country in the Middle East that ever had their eyes on world power had their eyes on Egypt. You got to hold Egypt. And so Assyria was marching down through here trying to get to Egypt, which is, oh, there's a fun little arrow, Egypt, which was right down there. So the king is camped here, and he sends his envoys up to Jerusalem just to remind them, don't trust Egypt. It's a rod that will pierce your hand if you lean on it. Yeah? Why didn't who send one person down where? Well, that maybe they had. And that's what the king of Assyria thinks, is that Hezekiah has been talking to Egypt. But what was God's constant call to the people of Israel? Don't go back to Egypt. Don't trust Egypt. Don't rely on them. You trust me. In fact, one of the Psalms talks about that. Some trust in horses, some trust in chariots, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. And so the constant call of the prophets to Israel was, don't trust in Egypt. Don't rely on them. Don't think that going back there is what's going to save you. Why is that? Because what's Egypt a picture of? Slavery. That's where you were. You don't go back there. For the Christian life, what's that the picture of? You don't go back to your former life. You've cut all ties with what you used to be and what you used to do. You live in trust with the Lord now. You don't go back there and think that's going to help you. So, the envoy comes up, don't trust in Egypt. Now, what else are we going to say here? Verse 22, but if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, he's anticipating the next response, isn't he? So if you're going to say to us, we trust our God, is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? What's he saying here?
In their eyes, that would weaken their God.
Ah, yes. Yeah, so fewer altars in the pagan Middle Eastern, in the ancient world's mind, fewer altars meant a weaker God. So, if Hezekiah has been removing altars to God and making people worship at only one altar, that means Jehovah must be weaker. What's the problems with that statement? God doesn't gain strength by altars, for one thing. And another thing? Who commanded the one altar? God did. So there's huge misunderstandings going into this statement. Hannah's talking about sharing with her friend today. And you talk to unsaved people, and they're going to throw questions at you that you say, that's not even the case. I don't even understand why you think that's an accusation against Christians. It's just not true. Now, some of them we can get behind because they say, oh, there's too many hypocrites in church. And we have to say, yeah, unfortunately there are. You know, we can't argue with that one. But sometimes, though, the Christians hate homosexuals, don't we? We just hate them. So, no, we don't. Why? That's not even an accurate portrayal of us. Christians think God is just this giant policeman trying to destroy all your fun. Is that an accurate representation of your faith? No, there's a lot of times we spend a lot of time defending our faith, not against accusations to our faith, but accusations of what people think our faith is, and trying to correct those bad views of what biblical faith is all about. And we have to correct that. And, you know, the first, second century, you read some of the apologists that wrote, not the biblical writers, but the people that came after that. And they have to defend against things like Christians being unpatriotic. Christians were cannibals. Christians were engaging in all kinds of horrific sex acts. And they said, where did this even come from? That's not the case at all. That's got nothing to do with us. And so you spend a lot of time just trying to figure out, where did you even get that idea? Well, Rabshakeh, wait a second. You're telling us not to trust God because we're worshiping at the altar that God told us to worship at? Oh, I get it. Oh, it's your bad theology. This is how you think of your gods. But hey, let me tell you something. This isn't how God is. This is the God who made the universe and set everything in place. This God does not need us to minister to him in order to be stronger. So there's a fallacy there, I'm sorry. Now continue your message, Rabshakeh. Now that we've got that straightened out, right? Verse 23, come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. What is this? It's an insult. You don't even have enough troops left to mount a defense. And so I'll tell you what, I'll give you the weapons. But I don't even think you have enough people to handle them. This is a huge intimidation factor. You don't even have enough troops left in Jerusalem to man 2,000 chariots. Now let me ask you, what good are chariots going to be in the vicinity of Jerusalem? Chariots are good for fighting on the plains, fields. They are lousy for fighting in the mountains. They don't do you much good. But the Rabshakeh doesn't seem to understand that. So he's threatening them. He's taunting them. Verse 24, how then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Moreover, is it without the Lord that I have come up against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's going on here? He's claiming that God sent him to destroy Jerusalem. Okay, why would he say that? Make him feel less secure, okay? You know one thing the ancient kings always did before they went to war? Always consulted the gods. They were very religious people. Do you know how they did it? They did things like reading tea leaves. You know, so you would get a cup of hot water and you'd sprinkle tea leaves in, and they would look at the patterns that were formed by them, and they'd say, oh, that means something. They had entire encyclopedias of what those patterns meant. They would sacrifice sheep, and they would pull out the innards and look at the shape of them. And they had entire encyclopedias of what little bumps on the liver meant. Because in their thinking, they believed that the physical world was an outworking of what was happening with the gods. And so if your God wanted you to go to war, it would be in some kind, he would tell you, with some kind of omen like a sheep's liver or some other omen. And we've talked about black cats crossing your path, breaking mirrors, walking under a ladder. Those were all bad omens. Right? The ancient world had many, many of them. I think back in, when was it? The 50s, I believe we unearthed a massive library in a country called Mari, which is north of Israel, up in the land of Syria. But huge, huge sets of encyclopedias on how to interpret omens, how to interpret dreams, how to interpret visions, so that they could determine what the gods wanted. And so the Rabshakeh here is probably referring to the fact that the king of Assyria would have consulted his gods and asked them, do they want me to go to war? Now, that's one possibility. The other possibility is that he is flat out lying in order to dishearten the people of Jerusalem and simply saying, you know what, God told us to come up here, so fooey on youy. So, you ever run into somebody, you're trying to talk to them, and they just simply say things like, well, God told me otherwise. Or, I don't believe the Bible's true. I think God is like this. Where does the conversation go from there? What's that, Kathy? Downhill. Yeah. It goes nowhere, does it? Yeah, that's right. Because you have just defaulted to opinion, haven't you? Yeah. Now, you can bring out of your toolbox some good arguments for the reliability of Scripture, but ultimately you're never going to argue somebody into belief that the Bible is God's Word. But what did the Israelites have at that time? Did God speak to them through omens? Did God speak to them through sheep's livers. How did God speak to them? Through the prophets. God is a verbal God. He communicates very clearly. And this is something that even people today don't understand about our God. He communicates very clearly, and he's done it right here. This is objective. This is not subjective. This is concrete. It's not abstract. I love when people say, well, you can make the Bible say anything you want. Sure you can if you ignore it. If you ignore what it says, you can make it say anything you want. But if you come to it looking at what it says, it has a very, very clear message. Theologically, we call this perspicuity. Not perspiration, perspicuity. And it means clearness. The Bible is clear on essential matters. Of course, people will always point to things like, well, why are there so many different denominations if the Bible is so clear? Well, for one thing, not all denominations believe the Bible means what it says. For another thing, there are some areas that we have questions about. We don't try to disavow that. But the important things, the gospel, the character of God, those things are clear. There might be some other things that are a little bit more difficult and take some more skill, but the important things are clear. God communicates verbally, he communicates clearly, and guess who's living in Jerusalem right now? Well, at least not right now, during this. Isaiah, the son of Amoz, the prophet. In fact, you can read this same account in Isaiah 37, 38, 39, because Isaiah writes it down. And so there is a prophet of God in Jerusalem right now, so they could just call Isaiah and say, Isaiah, did God tell this guy to come destroy the city? And of course Isaiah would say, no, God wants you to trust him. Just hang on there. I know it looks awfully bleak, but what is God not able to do? Has the arm of the Lord been shortened? Is God going to let Jerusalem be destroyed? No. So you can tell the Rabshakeh that he is lying. He's not right. So the Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Verse 26, then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joah, said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah within the hearing of the people who are on the wall. So what language would the Judeans have been speaking? Hebrew. Right. Aramaic is another. It's not a form of Hebrew. They're kind of from the same root languages. But Aramaic is what was being spoken over in Babylon and Assyria and those areas. It was kind of the universal language of the day. And so the Rabshakeh is speaking in Aramaic, and the officers of Judah say, oh, don't talk to us in Aramaic. Talk to us in... Did I get that wrong? No, I'm sorry. Don't talk to us in Hebrew. Talk to us in Aramaic. Why do you think they wanted that? Yeah, he doesn't want them discouraging and disheartening the people on the wall. So probably the people on the wall only know Hebrew. They don't know Aramaic. And so he wants them to not hear this conversation. But the Rabshakeh sees through this ruse and doesn't go along with it. Verse 27, the Rabshakeh said to them, has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and to drink their own urine? In other words, they're part of this decision too. I'm really hoping that they will turn against King Hezekiah and stop this before we have to come in and siege the city and do the same thing to you that we did to Samaria, which is make you sit in the city and wait this thing out, which is always bad news. So verse 28, then the Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah. So now he's purposely speaking in a language that everybody can understand. Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you out of my hand. True statement? Kind of a trick question, isn't it? Can Hezekiah deliver them out of the Assyrian king's hand? No. But God can, right. Hezekiah can't do it. That's true. Verse 30. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord by saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. That is a false statement. Hezekiah was encouraging the people to trust the Lord, and they should trust the Lord. Verse 31. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me, and come out to me. Then each one of you will eat his own vine and each one of his own fig tree, and each one of you will drink the water of his own cistern until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive trees and honey, that you may live and not die. And do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you by saying, the Lord will deliver us. So here's your options, people. Stay in the city, listen to Hezekiah, eat your own dung and drink your own urine, or come out, serve the king of Assyria, eat grapes, drink wine. Let's see here. Grapes or dung? Wine or urine? Oh, this is a tough call, isn't it? Anybody eating supper after service tonight? Okay. Or pizza? No, pizza's off the menu. Yeah, isn't that terrible? Okay. So he's trying to paint this picture like, if you serve Hezekiah and listen to Hezekiah and serve the Lord, there's only bad, horrible things waiting for you. But if you come out and serve me, king of Assyria, I'm going to take you to a whole new land, a better land. Land full of fig trees, land with honey. It'll be a great place. You'll love it. What's he telling them? I'm going to deport you just like I deported the northern kingdom. You're getting scattered, but you might as well do it enjoying yourself, right? Same kind of temptation hits us today when we're facing really tough stuff. Because temptation will scream at you, if you do this God's way, everything will be ruined. It'll be hard. It'll be arduous. Nothing will work out the way that you're thinking it will work out. God is not going to make this work for you. But if you do it my way, the music softens. Don't you love those commercials, infomercials on TV where they show the person trying to like cut a tomato with a knife and it's just smashing it and it's all black and white? And then the music shifts, and the picture goes to color, and they've got the new Ginsu knife, and it's just slicing right through the tomatoes. That's the kind of nonsensical portrayal that the Rabshakeh has given here. But that's the picture. You're going to choose either good things serving the king of Assyria, or you're going to choose death, destruction, dung, and urine by serving the Lord. Now, does the Lord sometimes bring hard stuff? Oh, yeah. Has he ever had you eating dung? Drinking urine? Hasn't gotten that bad, has it? Have you ever been faced with a time where you were tempted to say, I don't know, God's way seems like this is going to be really hard. And that path over there looks kind of easy. It looks bright and cheery, soft. Over here looks dark and dreary. That I think, is the picture that temptation will always give you, to make God's way look like the worst way possible to do something. And that's what Hezekiah and his people are getting faced with here. And it sure looks like the Rabshakeh is telling the truth, because this is a massive army. Israel does not have the ability to defend against it. He keeps taunting. Have the gods of the nations ever delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Syria? And up until this point, they haven't. Assyria has conquered everything it has touched. Every god of every other nation has been destroyed and absorbed into the Assyrian pantheon. They're all gone, including the northern kingdom of Israel, which apparently worshiped Jehovah. Right? Remember, they were not a completely pagan nation. They didn't do very good, but they still claimed to worship Jehovah, and Assyria already beat them. So what does that say about Assyria's God? He's stronger. He's bigger. He's stronger. So we've already proved that Assyria's God is stronger than Jehovah. So don't trust the Lord. Who among all the gods... Sorry, I skipped a couple there. Verse 34. Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Evah? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their lands out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? Nobody else has done it, therefore God can't do it. Verse 36, but the people were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's command was, do not answer him.